you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have James Perloff back on the show. James is an author of several books, including Shadows of Power and Truth is a Lonely Warrior. His website is jamesperloff.com. James, how are you doing this evening?
Well, I'm doing good. Very nice to be back on your show. By the way, I hear more and more people saying good things about you, Tim. I hear your name coming up more and more often. And by the way, I see you, it looks like you just did a show on Victor Rothschild. Is that correct?
Yes, I did, with Mark Hackard, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't actually hear the show, but Rothschild was always an interesting character to me. I did read Roland Perry's book about him called The Fifth Man, which proposed he was the fifth man of the Burgess MacLean, Philby Blunt spiring. I don't know if that was the perspective of your guest last night, but he was certainly a powerful man. And I know that Hilaire de Berryer, who ran a newsletter before the internet out of Monaco, referred to Victor Rothschild and called him the most feared man in Britain. So, always an interesting character.
Yeah, Mark Hackard wrote an article. He translated an article by a Russian. There was a KGB, the head of the KGB for a little while, Serov, I think was his name. Apparently, he had a diary, and they found hidden in his wall that he had made contact with Rothschild. Never trusted him, thought he was double-dealing, and I think this says a lot about not only the Rothschild family, but the Cold War and the true nature, you know, of that, supposed, I guess, standoff between East and West. How it was sort of a, well, it suggests that the whole thing was sort of at a meta level, at least, staged or controlled. It's a controlled dialectic. And that isn't to say that, you know, many of the people at the lower levels were in good faith or fighting for both sides, but at the meta level, the bankers, these things had kind of set this up. The Cold War, even the world, the Second World War, and it got into sort of the Rothschild's intrigues regarding the formation of Israel. So
right, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, I'm learning more about the Cold War and always reevaluating it. So that'll be an interesting listen, the one you did last night or recently with this gentleman.
Yeah, it's a good interview. Well, tonight I saw a couple of articles that you recently penned. One, I thought they were worthy of discussion. One is Christianity and the Truth Movement. How much do they coincide? And the second one is the real reason there was a golden age of television. So, James, you want to tackle the first one, Christianity and the Truth Movement?
Sure. Yeah, these are my website, jamesperloff.com. And, you know, Christianity and the Truth Movement, they should be harmonizing. And I want to talk a little bit about why they should be in harmony and a little bit why they're not. You know, as a hippie, this is back around 1970, you know, I was loosely involved with the anti-war movement. And at that time, we had did have a perception or recognition of the fact that there was a wealthy elite in America. We didn't understand it. We knew nothing about the Federal Reserve. We never heard of the Council on Foreign Relations. We called it the establishment, maybe called it the man. We knew that the rich people running things. But our perception of the powers that be was from a basically from a Marxist perspective, which is that you had these rich guys and their motivation was simply wealth. They wanted to exploit the poor in order to expand their riches. In other words, Rockefeller maybe had a lot of mansions, but he wanted bigger mansions and more mansions. And, you know, that actually doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's kind of the limit that we had. But with the growth of the truth movement and the acceleration of information through the internet, it's become increasingly clearer that the powers that be, they're not primarily motivated by money. Money is something they certainly use. There's no question about that. They use money to bribe people as an incentive for the people who run their system. You know, you're a compliant banker or network newscaster or general. You know, you're going to get paid a lot of money. And so on the surface, it might look like this is just a financial operation, but actually it's become clear that this is actually a representation of what the Bible refers to as, or Christianity refers to as a spiritual warfare. And at the top, it's really Luciferian. And so, I mean, there's a lot of examples that have come out about that. I'm sure you've seen the interview with Ronald Bernard, the Dutch currency manipulator.
Yeah, yeah.
Who talks about how there's 8,000 people that run the world, and he was working for these people for a long time, a very wealthy man. But when he really could not tolerate it was when he was asked to participate in child ritual sacrifice. And we've seen a lot of validation of this in recent years. You know, the videotaping of Bohemian Grove, where they have a mock human sacrifice, or some say it's a real human sacrifice in front of a statue of Moloch. And, you know, the spirit cooking thing, that whole thing that came out before the election with John Podesta. The late Ted Gunderson, who was at one time the special agent in charge of the FBI's Los Angeles branch, spoke a great deal about the Satanism of the elite. As did William Guy Carr back in the 50s. He was in Canadian intelligence. And then you've got, you know, the occult rituals of Skull and Bones, where they lie in a tomb, which is really an invitation to demonic forces. And, of course, at the upper levels of Freemasonry, the covert levels, certainly not the lower Blue Lodge Masons, but I mentioned this in the post that many, many years ago I had an encounter with a Freemason, he appeared to be of high rank, who openly spoke of Satanism. And he told me that there was a church in a Catholic church in Washington, D.C., and his firm had been hired to do work on this church. And he said that he carved images of Satan into the eyes of the statue of the Virgin Mary. And then he was using curse words, but he said those blankety-blank in Catholics. Now, when they bow before Mary, they'll really be bowing before Satan. They won't even know it. Now, he clearly associated his Freemasonry with Satanism, as well as, by the way, antipathy towards Catholicism, which the more I study, the New World Order is clear that Freemasonry is adverse to Catholicism and to traditional forms of Christianity.
And the important point here is, I'm sorry for my interruption, is
go ahead, please.
The way of opposing Catholicism isn't fighting it head on. It's unfortunately through gradual infiltration, which we see much evidence of today.
Oh, yes. And even going back to the 1930s, when according to Bella Dodd, who was a former communist official who eventually rejected Christianity. She said there were more than 1,000 communists were ordered to enter the Catholic Church and become bishops and monsignors. And she said, you won't recognize the Catholic Church. And that,
She rejected Christianity or communism?
She rejected Christianity. She rejected communism after a while and returned to her Catholic faith that she'd been brought up with. But she talked about the infiltration. There's no question in my mind. You know, a lot of people think that the Catholic Church is somehow inherently evil. It's not. It's been the victim of infiltration, which has been successful, I'll have to say, to a very substantial degree.
We see it sort of an exoteric level because of the Cold War and the CIA's use of the Vatican, and particularly the papacy of John Paul II, and how a lot of the Catholic hierarchy got on board the Cold War agenda and made a lot of theological and I think spiritual compromises because of that.
I didn't know that was coming from the CIA, but I know that ever since Vatican II, there's been, and I'm not a Catholic myself, I recently converted to Orthodoxy from an evangelical background. But I know that the Catholic Church has been certainly infiltrated and with the intent to distort its mission and to actually turn it to evil purposes. And our current Pope, 269-page encyclical on global warming. And I think when he went before the UN, he didn't even mention Christ. And this is not the sort of tradition you would have seen of the popes of the past. I'm sure you would agree.
And and also the spread of ecumenism in the Catholic Church since the
60s. But we see signs of Luciferianism everywhere. You know, the unveiling of the Baphomet statue in Detroit. And you've got Madonna dressing up as Baphomet for the Super Bowl halftime show. And Lucifer's got his own TV show now. It's called Lucifer. And all the anti-Christian modifications being made to our culture, the gay marriage legalization, the transgenderism. It's very clear that the New World Order is not simply about money. It's really a spiritual thing. It's really Luciferian, and money is what they use to motivate people. And because of that, I think it should become increasingly clear to people in the truth movement that Christianity is their natural ally. After all, in the Bible, the nemesis of Lucifer is Jesus, and the demons greatly feared him. And they said, "Have you come to take us before our time?" And we know who you are, the Holy One of God. And we've also seen, by the way, that the New World Order has historically persecuted Christians. The slaughter of Christians in Russia under the Bolsheviks, probably the worst genocide in history. And people talk about the Armenian genocide and the Ukrainian genocide, but they fail to mention usually that these were Christians that were being assaulted. And I did an article on David Dionysi's book. You probably had him on. He did a book on the bombing of Nagasaki. And I had not known this before, but that Nagasaki was actually the Christian center of Japan. And that's why it was targeted, because when the emperor was forced to renounce his faith at the end of World War II by the victorious Allies, they did not want Christianity to fill the vacuum.
It's also interesting that the test site that they used for the atomic bomb was was called Trinity.
Right. And they also had a Catholic and Protestant clergyman bless the bomb before it took off, and both men regretted that very much later on when they realized how much destruction had actually been inflicted upon the Japanese people. So the New World Order persecutes Christians. And of course, in America, it's much more restrained. You know, we just see things like ridicule of Christians and Christian bakers being fined and threatened with jail for not cooking gay wedding cakes. And we see God kicked out of schools.
You make that point. Is the removal of school prayer and of God from the public schools was largely implemented by the Supreme Court, which is dominated by Freemasons, correct?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, this is something people don't know. This is something I actually mentioned in the Golden Age of Television article because it changes television. That's coincided. Right. But I'll mention it now.
Yeah, yeah, it's funny because I'm melding the two articles. I was thinking, I'm sorry.
But on June 17th, 1963, the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional to read the Bible in school. And prior to that, they'd ruled that it was unconstitutional to pray. So at that point, there was no more God in our schools. But five of the Supreme Court justices, I'll name them, Hugo Black, William O. Douglas, Tom C. Clark, Potter Stewart, and the Chief Justice, Earl Warren, were Freemasons. And so that gave them a guaranteed majority in the Supreme Court. And I should just mention that one thing that I've come to realize, I can't prove this, but I honestly believe this very strongly, Tim, is that Freemasons consider their oath of loyalty to Freemasonry to be higher than any oath of loyalty to the Constitution. And that's why these guys violated the Constitution. And because the Constitution is not what got them their cushy, high-ranking jobs, what got them into those jobs was their status as Freemasons. And so there was simple, this was payback. You know, this is when you're, as they said in the movie Brother of the Bell, your bill has come due. So, the Freemasons very much a part of this. And so there should be a natural alliance between Christians and truthers, as we see that there are Luciferians at the head of this, because it's the Luciferians not only persecute the Christians historically, but we see them right now persecuting the truth, as we see whistleblowers like Susan Lindauer and Scott Bennett thrown into prison. And we see the Facebook accounts of someone like Partisan Girl. She lost her Facebook account and her YouTube account. And even people like Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and Richie Allen in the UK, and Richie Abal had the YouTube account shut down. Now, I think they've got them back up now. But even my book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, was suspended for a while last year. And more they've been cracking down on what they call fake news, which is actually the true news, in an effort to suppress this, because the truth movement, the alternative media, has been so successful and has really outpaced the mainstream media, which is simply there for their salaries, whereas we're motivated by something much, much, much higher, which is to try to bring the truth to people. So there should be this unity. I mean, Jesus himself, I didn't do the count, but somebody else said, did that Jesus said 78 times, I tell you the truth in the New Testament, and he called Lucifer the father of lies. And so you would think that Christian pastors would be align themselves with the truth movement, seeing how it's a persecutor of both them and the truth movement. And you'd think that more and more truthers would be embracing Christianity, since Lucifer is really the one who's at the top of this New World Order that's persecuting them. Yet we don't see them coming together very much, do we? For the most part, they're still going along in their separate ways, at least I think.
Yeah, I think large of that is driven by cognitive infiltration, sort of get into the movement and divide it. You can have a lot of agent provocateurs you just create that meme, and it kind of follows its own logic. Also, a lot of people that I think you talk about this in the article is a lot of people who come from the who would identify as truthers or in the truth movement themselves tend to be very skeptical towards organized religion and religion in general. And that leaves so they become very vulnerable perhaps to the blandishments of Satan, perhaps.
Right, and with good reason they've become suspicious of organized religion, I should say. But there's different reasons why they might reject Christianity. I mean, I know people in the truth movement who are Muslims, for sure, and I know some who are New Agers, and I know some who are outright agnostics, and some who are actually, I know some who are very hostile towards Christianity. In fact, I might have mentioned this in the article. I have a friend who's a truther, and his mom is very ex-Catholic because she was groped by the priest at her confirmation. I mean, and she gave up on it. And that guy was probably one of those infiltrator types that Ella Dodd was talking about, you know. And they give their purpose is to give the faith as bad a name as they can. But on the Protestant side, you know, when I was attending evangelical churches, I would, you know, sometimes bring some truth or friends, but, you know, the situation was hopeless because the pastor was, he was Zionized and he was pro-Israel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be pro-Israel, you also have to be pro-war, and you have to think that these wars are patriotic. And so the wars would be, we would always be hearing from the pulpit how good the wars were and how they were being fought for our liberties, which they're not. I mean, we're not in Afghanistan for our liberties. We went there supposedly because of Osama bin Laden not being given to us by the Afghan government. Well, he's been dead for 7 years now. If you buy the official "we threw him in the ocean" 2011 story, why are we still there? Or how about Iraq? We're not defending our liberties there. We went there because they had weapons of mass destruction, which it turned out didn't exist. And then Bush, you know, he twisted the slogans and said now it's all about Iraqi freedom and all this other nonsense. And if you preach that from the pulpit, there's two things. Number one, people who are wise to these things know that you're not telling the truth, and they're not going to trust you to light the pathway to God, because God is truth. If you don't know the basic truth is about the world around you.
It's also a function, I guess, and I think you addressed this in the article, is that it's very awkward or difficult for a pastor to address, you know, for lack of a better term, truth issues, because you're dealing in a view of politics, a view of how the world works, which is outside the matrix. And how does one from the pulpit address that, in, you know, in a church setting where you don't want to be overly political?
Right.
Yeah. And at the same time, churches, because of, and you mentioned, because of this 501c3 tax exempt, if they get political, they run afoul of the IRS, they can get in a lot of trouble. And that's kind of used to put a muzzle on the church, to make sure churches don't get too militant, when actually the proper understanding of the church is it should be militant.
Right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The kind of churches I'm talking about, I don't think they get any trouble because they're supporting the government's agenda.
Well,
that 501c3 would probably kick in at that point.
That's the point you make. Is they're plenty political. It's just they're speaking from inside the matrix. And then when you're political in that way, they support you. Talking about promoting the narrative, more or less the narrative of the past 100 years in this country. And they do. They particularly the evangelical churches. You know, with the and we did a talk a while back about the Scofield Bible and the corruption of a lot of the evangelical Protestant churches. But even a lot of the Catholic churches, I'm Catholic, I listen to the homilies. They're very generic for the most part. They say things like, you know, prayers to support the troops and things like that. They do say, you know, keep them, you know, free from harm, which I have no problem with. But of course, the best way to keep our troops free from harm is to take them out of, you know, pull them back and get and stop occupying foreign countries and stop fighting these elective foreign wars to just drive the country into debt and create more enemies and more or less support the military industrial complex. So, they do play a part, because when they're obviously on the pulpit or up on the altar and they're spreading lies, and a percentage of the congregation or the people in the pews know they're not hearing the truth, it does engender contempt towards that person and the position he holds and what he supposedly represents.
Right, and this is one of the things that actually finally drove me out of the evangelical churches. I found that their theology had been so distorted. Again, we talked about this when we discussed the Scofield Reference Bible. The theology itself has been distorted, but to hear these messages, which are not just wrong, they're not just making a mistake, they're actually Luciferian. Now, they're not consciously Luciferian. They would abhor the idea of consciously doing some Luciferian, but actually, they're actually, without knowing it, it's Luciferian. And for me, I couldn't sit any longer in the pews and have someone try to school me in something that I know comes from Lucifer. This whole Greater Israel project is straight out of the Rothschilds and Theodore Herzl's playbook, and I can't go along with it, and I can't go along with bombing innocent people. You know, Afghanistan did not attack us, Iraq did not attack us, Libya did not attack us, Syria did not attack us, but we have made war on all of these countries unprovoked. It's shameful, and to hear from the pulpit that you know, we're defending our liberties and freedoms. I can't take that. And this is one of the things, along with certain theological ideas, like the idea that Jesus is going to become a earthly king, which is what he rejected when he was here, and that we're going to need to rebuild the temple. And, you know, Christians have contributed millions of dollars to that. Jesus said the temple's going to be torn down. And the idea that Jesus is going to reign from the temple from 1,000 years. I know this is a very controversial idea, but I've seen this in a lot of doctrinal statements. But Jesus said, if anyone says to look for me in the inner rooms, don't believe them. Yet, in spite of all the warnings he gave, I saw doctrine in so many evangelical churches that was in support of these new ideas that have been introduced basically over the past century. And I could no longer tolerate what I was saying. And the thing I should mention that just goes along with this, and this is another thing that I think keeps truthers away from the churches, is, you know, Martin Luther had some reasonable complaints when he posted his 95 Theses. There were reasonable complaints, no doubt about it. But the problem was, when the church splintered, it never stopped splintering. And it splintered into JFK said, I'll splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. Well, that's what happened to the church. And so people don't even know what church to go to, because has this denomination got it right? Has this denomination got it right? And of course, you know, for the first 1,000 years, essentially, there was just one church. And that wasn't, you didn't have to worry about that kind of thing. But that's another thing that has hampered people's the unity that should exist between the truth movement and the church, and is one reason why I've gone traditional. The more I've looked, the more I find that to find the truth, you have to go back in time. You don't go forward in time. You don't have, you know, so many elder boards and pastors. They develop their own form of worship, and they decide what will be most seeker sensitive, and they get further and further away. And what I love about, just the Orthodox Church in particular, and it's not to plug it particularly, but is that we're using the same liturgy, essentially, that was used in the 4th century, which is, you know, it's the century when the Council of Nicaea met under Emperor Constantine. And I love that authenticity. You know, a lot of people think that liturgy is boring because it essentially stays the same from week to week. What I love about liturgy is that it maintains the stability and thus the authenticity of worship. And well, that's me, and that's where I'm at. And I do believe I'm speaking the truth there. And but I do believe that that splintering of the church, along with infiltration in Catholicism and the infiltration of evangelical churches as well, with the Scofield Reference Bible, has really put a lot of people off who otherwise we'd love to see a lot of more people in the truth movement coming to faith and actively worshiping.
And that's also going back to perhaps something that a flaw or virus, if you will, in the software that, you know, that is America, is this whole notion of separation of church and state. right, which isn't in the Constitution, but the idea that pluralism, this goes back to America is a proposition nation, pluralism, and what it does, what it has effectively done, is just effectively kept the church weak, because there's so many churches, and the idea is you can practice however any way you want, so long as you just do it on Sunday and don't bother anyone else the rest of the week. And you can even have your churches, you can have your buildings, your infrastructure, but really, you're not supposed to have any real impact on the on government, because that's violation of separation of church and state. And that's how some countries are, traditional countries are, confessional states and these things, and that's considered illiberal and retrograde. And America has done a good part in even destroying those countries, like Catholic Spain or Portugal. The CIA went in and undermined those countries. Perhaps a Freemasonic project in the final analysis.
Sure.
But a good example is the credibility for Christianity, whether it's Catholicism, even the mainline Protestant churches, is if the Catholic Church had actually come out against American involvement in the First World War and the Second World War, and actually, said, no, you as Catholics, you cannot participate in the slaughter. That would have gone a long way in preventing those disasters. Instead of saying, no, we have to keep quiet, we have to be loyal Americans. We're Americans first and Catholics second. And that's, again, a problem with Americanism itself, is the idea that Americanism, America takes precedent over Catholicism, because you got to be a good, loyal American. You can't really cause too much trouble. And I'm speaking, you know, from a Catholic's perspective, is a lot of Catholics have always had an inferiority complex with vis-a-vis the WASP establishment. And they always want to have their place at the table, you know, their rise through the ranks and have their guys in charge and holding political office. But there's a compromise there. Maybe there isn't a proper place at the table for Catholics in the United States, because the United States itself, well, it was largely a Freemasonic project,
right?
In the final analysis. So maybe you should be outside looking in instead of trying to elbow your way into the onto the table so you can get, you know, a few crumbs. But that's what, you know, a lot of Catholic politicians and officials and judges and these things, they sell out to the system and they lose their Catholic identity, which probably should be somewhat, I would say, countercultural and counter to the system, as opposed to being good, loyal Americans and Catholics at the same time, you know.
Absolutely. You're very right about America being a Freemasonic project. In fact, I got into this briefly. I did a show with a guy who hasn't been uploaded yet. The last podcast I did, he wanted to talk about who wrote the Declaration of Independence. And you know, it was actually not Thomas Jefferson at all, who didn't even mention writing it until 45 years after the fact. And even then he did it so in a very vague way. But it's actually written by Thomas Paine, who Benjamin Franklin had brought over here in late 1774 to write Common Sense, to rile the people up for revolution. And then, being the best pen around, there's a plentitude of evidence that just from the style of the writing of the Declaration that he wrote it. It was definitely a Freemasonic project, and he was as anti-Christian as they get. I mean, he wrote a book called The Age of Reason, where he just wailed on the Bible. He just denounced the Bible and called it the Bible full of lies and paltry tales and things of that nature. And he said he spent his life working against Christianity. And so when people talk about the Christian founding fathers, no, I'm not buying. But that's another message that the evangelical churches have bought into. It's something they got a lot, largely from guys like David Barton, who's very pro-Israel. But to be pro-Israel, you've got to convince people that Christianity is all wrapped up in war and in our national identity, and you're an American first and a Christian second, as you were saying. We were sort of the first country to throw off a monarch, and then we became the sort of the launching pad. This was the new Atlantis, as Francis Bacon put it. They were reconstructing Atlantis, the satanic world that God had destroyed with the flood. That was their vision, at least. And they wanted to use America as the engine of revolutions throughout the world, who thought they would get the same types of liberties we had here. None of them ever did, whether it was the Bolshevik Revolution, the French Revolution, wherever. America, I think, probably got a good deal, because, you know, when you want to get a sucker into a poker game, you first deal him a four aces, so he thinks it's his lucky night. And America got the four aces, but all the other revolutions really turned out pretty rotten for everybody who took place in them. There was mass slaughter wherever they took place. I think that a big part of that, which ties back to our conversation about the clergy and the truth movement, was eliminating the monarchs, because the monarchs, starting with Constantine, had been designated as the protectors of the church. And whether it was a czar in Russia or the Kaiser in Germany, or the emperors of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or even the King of England styled himself defender of the faith. They were the defenders of the faith, and the Rothschilds and their underling Freemasons and the New World Order wanted to amputate those defenders of the faith and leave the churches defenseless. And one of the things I realized was that historically, one reason that pastors and priests don't speak a lot on politics is that in their tradition, They didn't need to do that because you had a Christian monarch and his army and his intelligence forces would take care of communists and revolutionaries and political enemies. And so the pastor or the priest could simply focus all his attention on spiritual matters, the giving of communion, the giving of sacraments. There's no need for him to worry about politics. But today, we're in a little different situation. All the defenders of the faith are gone. The monarchs, the czars, the emperors, they're all gone. And the church is defenseless. And I think that clergymen need to rise to the occasion as much as possible and become politically awake to fill that void that's been created.
Yeah, I don't see, I imagine you'd ever see a Louis the 16th draping Versailles in a rainbow flag or Tsar Nicholas II doing that and celebrating, you know, and we see Barack Obama's White House doing that just after the Supreme Court's, you know, decision, mm-hmm. which no one knew was coming down because that wasn't contrived at all, you see. you know, it was an honest reading of the law, right? Gay marriage. I mean, that's an example. Is that this gets into again? This runs counter to what most Americans are trained to believe in. Is the idea of Republican democracy, elected officials, and these things as if paper constitutions and legislatures and pause of law are going to protect our liberties as men, and they obviously they haven't. And if you really take a clear look at the corruption of the American system, elections are controlled. It's really American democracy or American republicanism really is a thin cover for oligarchy. At least in a monarchy, you may have a commercial class, wealthy class. But if you have a tradition of a monarchy, which claims its legitimacy from God, at least theoretically, that monarchy will transcend any oligarchic power. Whereas in their Masonic West, with our liberal constitutions, the oligarchs rule through their installed courts and legislatures, and they have the money, and they control the media, and they control the public consciousness. They can spread diseases in the public mind through the media, and in effect, there is no protection. There's no one there to stand up for tradition and honor. At least theoretically, you may get that with a monarchy. You don't get that with an elected, with a selected president and 535, legislatures that are legislators who are mostly bought and paid for by the Israeli lobby.
Exactly, which is why just today we saw, as we're recording this, Donald Trump is now to his breaking the Iran agreement, which came as a surprise to no one. And he's been on that under the thumb of the Israeli lobby, even before he became president, of course, and that's why he's there right now. Mm-hmm. But we keep moving in the direction of the New World Order. They wanted those monarchies gone for both political and spiritual reasons, I'm convinced. And actually, I believe that one of the reasons for all these attacks on Syria, these ludicrous cruise missile bombings over no evidence except the one video taken by the white helmets, even though everybody who was in that hospital video denied there was a chemical weapons attack, and just in violating the Constitution and not waiting for proper evidence. So many reasons not to do that. I believe that one reason we're seeing Syria attacked is that they have a strong Christian population. We talked before about the Christian persecutions, right? Mm-hmm. There's over almost 2 million Christians in Syria right now, and they're faithful, and they fight alongside the Muslims against the ISIS and the al-Nusra terrorists that the U.S. and Saudis are backing. But I have to say that Syria is the strongest remaining stronghold of Christianity in the Middle East right now, and that's one reason why it's under attack. And I also believe that has to do with the adversity being shown in the mainstream media towards Russia, because Russia is in the midst of a tremendous Christian revival. They've had 25,000 new churches open since the Soviet Union collapsed. Whether or not we accept that as a genuine collapse, there's no question about the Christian revival. You try to have a gay parade in Russia, they'll beat you up. They don't allow it, and the textbooks there are so Christian that the liberals in Russia complain about it. And that's, I believe, the adversity towards Syria and Russia. There is a spiritual warfare undercurrent to that that goes beyond just wanting to get natural gas and oil reserves there in Syria, even though that's part of it. You know, that's part of the lower level incentive. But I think at the deepest level, it is a spiritual battle.
Yeah, there's a revival of sort of an ethno-religious consciousness in Russia, which transcends even Vladimir Putin, who's just a politician at the end of the day. And if you have that ethno-religious consciousness, which is, by the way, anti-Masonic and anti-liberal, counter to the West, which is propositional nations, right? We don't have, there are no ethno-states in the West. We're supposed to have republics in like America as a proposition nation. But with Russia, you have no idea of soil, ethnos, and religion. And you get this mm-hmm. idea in the East. The further East you get from Western Europe, this identity becomes stronger. It's stronger in Poland than it is in Germany. And because of that, Poland now is now fighting back against sexual liberation and the gay agenda because the Poles identify as Polish Catholics. And mm-hmm. that's a bulwark against some of this moral insanity we're seeing. Same thing with Hungary. Hungary is a very small country. I think it was E. Michael Jones who used to talk about Hungary. He says, you know, you need to preserve Hungarian culture and language. It's like you're in a secret society. Only a few people speak Hungarian. Why do you want to dilute that? You know, and so there's Orban in Hungary who's fighting
right.
migration, which is being spurred on by the West, by NATO, by one of the things by creating a crisis in Syria and Libya and these areas. And I do think, yeah, Syria, obviously, its historical significance in Christianity is clear. I mean, the road to Damascus, right? St. Paul. And mm-hmm. a lot of the fighting you're seeing is the destruction of some of this older architecture. It's a form of iconoclasm. The same thing perhaps you saw in Germany, World War II, with the bombing of Dresden and sort of the destruction of old Europe. And you needed to destroy the architecture to have the psychological effect on Germans, to decapitate them spiritually and psychologically, destroy these cities that were millennia old. And I think a lot of it. And of course, you have this with ISIS and the fomenting of some of these Islamic extremists in the West, many people see as Muslims as the enemy of Christianity, when in actuality, Muslims are probably closer to Christianity than Jews are, because Judaism is an outright rejection of Christianity by definition. Whereas at least Islam looks at Jesus as a prophet. I don't agree with that, you know, that interpretation of Jesus Christ in right. his life. But nevertheless, there's admiration for Jesus Christ. Whereas if you read the Talmud, there not much admiration for Jesus Christ in the Talmud. But the whole purpose of the Schofield Reference Bible and the Zionist takeover of the evangelical churches is to obscure that fact in most, if not many Christians. And I've even seen a lot of Catholics as they've been bought out. You know, the Zionist infiltration of the Vatican and also neoconservative Catholics, that's the whole function of the war on terror was to create that perception, create a competing blood libel. In this case, directed at the Muslims.
Right, and of course, Albert Pike said that the final world war would be, I believe, initiated by a war between Christendom and Islam, and mm-hmm. certainly we see Israel, which, if you go to the WikiSpooks article, 9/11 Israel did it. You know, they're the ones who did 9/11. You go all the way back through the King David Hotel bombing, the Levant affair, the attack on the USS Liberty, the LaBelle discotheque. Again and again, Israel has attacked us disguised as Arabs. You know, the attack on the USS Liberty, they flew in unmarked planes, hoping that we'd get into the six-day war, mm-hmm. as it turned out to be 6 days, on their side. It's happened again and again. By the way, Tim, you raised some interesting points. You were talking about the ethnocentricity of some of the smaller nations like Hungary. I just wanted to add Iceland to that list. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you're isolated like Iceland is, you get to be pretty culturally stable. And of course, they've had they took some very innovative step by throwing bankers into jail there. Mm-hmm. That certainly made some alt media headlines. And you also talked about the destruction of architecture. I thought that was interesting because Tex Mars just this past year came out with a book on satanic architecture being built all around the world. And he's got a lot of photographs of it, you know, the Freemasonic and satanic symbolism in the architecture. in preparation for the rule of an Antichrist figure. But I'd forgotten that along with that, you would also need to destroy the Christian architecture. And of course, the bombing of Dresden, you know, they pointed out that Dresden was turned to ashes on Ash Wednesday. Mm-hmm. The timing of that attack, we mentioned before, Nagasaki being targeted because it was Christian. There are clearly quite a few activities that take place that have a spiritual value or meaning that go beyond the you know, what we see in the headlines about you know, this was the latest endeavor in the war to achieve victory. Mm-hmm. There's definitely spiritual undertones to just about everything we see taking place.
Mm-hmm. And especially with, yeah, if you look at the modern architecture since Vatican II in the churches, in the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. how that's changed, completely changed the whole atmosphere, and ultimately the solemnity of the Mass and the liturgy has changed along with the architecture. Obviously, the ending of the Latin Mass and these things, and it has it played a big part in sort of the crisis in the Catholic Church since the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That modernist trend in these things. So these things do matter. I mean, obviously, architecture, like anything, it's a form of artwork, and also it's a cultural expression. And if you look at modern architecture, just like modern art, it's there to either confuse or diminish the human being. As far as Christianity, anything else you want to say in that article, or do you think we covered it? Or
I think we pretty well covered it. The other question, I guess, would just be how to. We know that the people in the Truth Movement are politically awake. You know, how to get them more into the churches. I think that has a lot to do, as we're saying, with the way the churches have become.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way also to make Christian pastors more alert to what's really going on? And I think that's really an individual matter because, you know, some of them have been so badly matrixed. You know, there, I should mention that there are, you know, of course, politically awake clergymen. And some examples, I mentioned Tex Mars, but there's Pastor Matt Furse, who's written on Israel, and of course Chuck Baldwin. He's now rejected Christian Zionism and neocon wars of aggression. And you know, you must be familiar with Bishop Richard Williamson.
Oh yeah, he talks about that's right.
He talks about 9/11. Of course, Brother Nathaniel on the Orthodox side, mm-hmm. but they're all in the minority. And from my personal experience, I've sat down with clergymen before, and you know, my approach is I bring a laptop with me. And I have an advantage, of course. I gave many, many PowerPoints on the New World Order, so I can actually go sit down and go with somebody step by step, the wars, the Fed, the media control. And that evolved actually into my book called Truth is a Lonely Warrior, because you have to give people the big picture. So I can be fairly convincing in a one-on-one presentation, but I also know that there's some people that some pastors who are going to be so deeply matrixed, they're just going to roll their eyes
mm-hmm.
no matter what you say to them. But I think that it takes building a relationship with the pastor and sitting down with him. And at least I think that pastors should be aware, because you see pastors, they will pray for, let's say, the victim of someone who's autistic, who's got a child that's born autistic. But wouldn't it be better if they actually knew that vaccines play a role in autism and they could actually counsel people against vaccines or at least explore it?
Mm-hmm.
It would be so helpful if they're politically awake. But like I said, for so long, their tradition was only the attending to people's souls, and that the matter of politics and the wiles of the devil was pretty much on a political level left in the hands of the defenders of the faith, the monarchs, who are gone now. So we're in an era that's pretty much not like any era that we've seen over the past millennium. It's a challenging time, but I think that we should do everything we can to try to reach clergy and also to draw attention to fellow people who are working in alt media and the Truth Movement to the fact that our enemy is Lucifer at the top of this New World Order, and that if they're not a person of faith, that maybe, you know, for their own sake, they should be looking at the realities of faith in God and where they came from and what their ultimate destiny is and why we're here. And, you know, I did I know some of them are caught up in the Darwinist point of view that we evolved by the Big Bang and Darwinist mechanisms. You know, I did an interview, if I can mention, on SGT Report that's had over 2 million views now. It's the most watched interview ever. It's called "Is God Real?" And we talk about all the deficiencies in Darwin's theory of evolution, and it's loaded with them. And people need to know that it's not scientific. And the fact is that we are creations of God. And I do hope and pray that that there can be a meeting place between the truth movement and Christianity, because God is truth. And in the alt media, we're solely motivated by truth. The two should be coming together. I'd love to see a point where the two could be acting as allies against the New World Order and its Luciferian masters.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can pray for that one day. Meantime, I guess just go out there and when you have the opportunity, have a conversation, talk to somebody. My experience, again, is from my from a Catholic perspective, it's very hard for a parish priest to address these things.
Right.
Even if he were sympathetic, because he'd have the whole hierarchy coming down on him. So this is one of the problems that perhaps, again, it's how does one, maybe he doesn't see it as something, as an appropriate issue, a controversial issue to say the least, to address from the pulpit. But right. At the same time, they have no problem, again, promoting the official narrative of events, and they don't realize that's equally controversial, especially for those people who are some in the know or somewhat savvy to these things. It becomes increasingly problematic as you tend to squirm in the pew as you hear some of these things.
Right.
At least that's my own personal experience.
And I don't see how a priest or a clergyman can completely separate themselves from politics, because when you've got transgenderism being taught in the schools and things like abortion, I don't see how things that are so obviously adverse to Christian values, how you can completely separate yourself from them. I don't see.
Yeah, because
you're sticking it. Yeah,
because the Luciferians they're implementing inversion or transvaluation, where what was once considered righteous or good is now evil, and what was evil is now good. And so if you are a practicing Christian and you are living out the values that the Christianity promotes, that it stands for, like sexual modesty or chastity, sanctity of marriage, sanctity of human life, these things are becoming increasingly not tolerated in the public square. Mm-hmm. Just a mere expression of a misgiving towards the homosexual lifestyle is liable to cost you your job, and some countries land you in jail.
Yeah, right.
It's called harassment in these things, and you're being increasingly sort of ostracized, and that's going to muzzle free thought and expression in these things, and that's how it's spread. At the same time, they're actively promoting it through publicly funded institutions like the courts or the public school system and these things. We're being forced to pay for this stuff. And don't tell me that the public school system is neutral, that the courts are neutral in these things. Don't insult my intelligence. Obviously, come on.
I won't, for sure. Somebody will, but not us.
When you're having transvestites read children's books to kids in public schools, it's obviously satanic. And you need the church to step up and become militant and not worry about their tax-exempt status, because they are being assaulted. And ultimately, the churches won't have anything to stand on if the lay people who ultimately pay for the church are spiritually corrupted or have their morale destroyed, or the note feel to have anyone standing up for him. And, you know, and the as the effects of the sexual revolution continue to reverberate throughout history, through, you know, into one generation after another, you have family breakup, dissolution, more mm-hmm. sexual dysfunction, all society deteriorates, and all the doctrines that these churches hold dear, you know, something like the Catholic Church in these matters, are going to fall on deaf ears because society's been corrupted, because the church wasn't militant, it didn't get involved in politics. You know, it's inherently political, you know. So
that was one of the things they taught, by the way, in Schofield's dispensationalism, was that the politics were a worldly affair, and so Christians should not involve themselves. Of course, the purpose of that was to make sure the Christian values were kept out of politics and out of the public place. And we see the end result of that in the culture around us.
Well, I mean, like you have St. Augustine, you know, Augustine with the city of man and the city of God. And, you know, in order, you know, we all yearn to get to the city of God. But in the meantime, we're in the city of man. We have to deal with the realities, you know, this imperfect world. But yeah, it's not acknowledging that we're not of this world doesn't mean that we don't play a part in it while we're here. And it's an attempt to sort of, I think, to have Christians have a unilateral surrender and say, well, it doesn't matter because, you know, at the end of the day, this life is short and we're concerned with eternity. The problem is you earn your way into eternity by doing the right thing while you're on, you know, while you're during your mortal life. And yeah. And so again, I think in the States and the West, it's become this idea where religion is sequestered. It's put off in this little corner. You're fine over there with your building and you can have your Friday fish fries and your pancake breakfasts. You can even have your schools, but you know, don't get involved in politics, you know. Or if you do, you have to endorse us. You know, you can have the right. breakfast and these things, but you know, no real opposition to the system. You know, so
absolutely. You know, and I know that if the kind of things that we see today, like you're talking about I think I have the same image in mind as you do when you talk about the transvestite reading to school children. I think we've seen that image of that guy who's in the totally satanic outfit talking to children. You know that a century ago, if that had happened, what kind of reaction there would have been, not only amongst the public, but in the churches. And the church absolutely has to step up and do what's right for the culture.
They
have to be active with the culture, or they really have made themselves irrelevant.
Well, but
because the whole congregation is being impacted by what's going on.
Yeah, well, the Catholic Church, pretty much as an institution, at least the American Catholic Church, more or less completely undermine the faithful, the Catholic. When they let in the name of civil rights and integration, destroy the Catholic neighborhoods, because this was the strength of the Catholic Church in the United States. And if you don't have an ethno community, you don't have a sense. You don't have a sense of community, so you can't bond together and work together to ward off and fight these things. And this is where the psychological warfare specialists were so effective, because under the guise of integration and suburbia and upward mobility, they destroyed ethno-religious identity in the United States. So everyone's deracinated. And in order to organize and to fight these things, you have to be able to trust your neighbor, have something in common with them. And you may be polite with your neighbor, you may be even friendly with your neighbor, but you're not gonna identify with them if you're Irish and he's Pakistani. It just isn't going to work. I'm sorry. No matter what people want it to believe, you know, there isn't this happy mosaic of a diversity. You have a divided and weak mass of people who can be manipulated by the oligarchs, and they know that. That's what they did with the suburbia when they replaced, you know, your ethno-religious identity with consumerism suburbia, you know.
Tim, you were the guy who first called that to my attention on a previous show we did together, and I thought it was just such a fantastic point that they eroded the Catholic churches by introducing suburbanism and broke up the ethnic neighborhoods. And you're right. You need that that unity that comes from commonality. and multiculturalism. I mentioned this in Truth is a Lonely Warrior because I had started to recognize it then when I published it 5 years ago now, that multiculturalism is just another word for division. And one of their chief strategies is divide and conquer. So they know that by breaking up us into a multicultural society, we will be divided, we'll not be together, and we won't be united enough to fight them. Yeah. That's integral to their strategy.
Yeah, yeah. And this is there's a case in Britain, the Telford scandal with these, I think there were Muslim immigrants who were raping children for decades in this town. And every time the locals tried to organize something, the government came down on them and said, you're discriminating against an oppressed minority. You know, and again, this is another case where a lack of ethnic consciousness and organization prevented them from responding in a way to prevent these crimes from continuing going on. You know, they couldn't get together, and it's so bad that it even worked all its way into the state where the police wouldn't do anything about it. You know,
incredible.
You know,
but where we know that that's all part of been all part of their plan for Europe. What they called was it the Calgary Plan?
Yeah,
and the whole plan of breaking up all the European states into these multicultural, diverse states. With Angela Merkel approving, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not more than a million, migrants into Germany, and completely changing the character of her nation, you know, a nation that's united by culture, language, religion, even cuisine, if you will, is going to be communicating with themselves, united, and very difficult to conquer. But once a nation is splintered into hundreds of different factions, like the Protestant Church, as we were mentioning before, you know, it's going to be very easy to manipulate and take over because it hasn't got the unity to fight.
And what's funny thing about it is when you talk about this issue, is the in the changing demographics of America and the decline, for lack of a better term, of the white population, the Caucasian population, the European population, the rise of you know, they call the browning or tanning of America, and if you're a white person, you're a person of European background, and you look askance at that, you're a little suspect of it. They immediately call you racist because you're worrying about the political ramifications of that demographic change in the country. Mm-hmm. They say, well, you must be a white supremacist or a racist. You're worried about this. But then if you read the literature, there was a recent article talking about the NRA. National Rifle Association, how this guy wrote an article saying how the gradual decline of the white population in America spells it's bad news for the NRA's long-term membership because people who aren't white have a different politics and don't have a high regard for the Second Amendment and perhaps other aspects of the U.S. other parts of the U.S. Constitution. Well, then he's conceding that argument, isn't he? He's saying that there is a qualitative change in politics if there's a change in demographics. So if that is the case and you want to defend a constitutional republic or what remains of it in this country, then you have to either prevent the demographic change or reverse it. It legitimizes, for lack of a better term, the white nationalist concern regarding demographics. They're conceding it in one breath, but then if you acknowledge their point and say, well, maybe we shouldn't have this change then they call you a racist. You know, so what you're saying is if America goes browner or tanner or darker, becomes more third world or less European, you're less of a European based culture, you're going to change, the politics is going to change. Well, that's a legitimate political concern. And if reversing demographics is the only way to hold off or to prevent that change from happening, then it's a legitimate position to take. You can't have it. I mean, they want to have it both ways.
Right. So what the Poles and the Hungarians are doing right now and some of the other countries are beginning to think about in Europe is quite legitimate. And
yeah.
I would say that they're probably on the same wavelength as you and I are, that they see the damage that's being done to their culture and what's going to happen in the future if they don't reverse those trends.
Yeah.
Too bad for America because we're already so multiculturalized.
We don't have the language for it because we're a proposition nation. you say. Yeah. Right? But the reality is, if you do the study of American history, is there was a time when America had ethnic enclaves, and this was sort of a modus vivendi with the elite, is with the industrialists, where you had ethnic Italian neighborhoods, Irish neighbors, Polish neighbors, and these things, enclaves. The Midwest was largely, Germanic. You know, people from Norway and Sweden and Germany and the Midwest and these things. But, you know, this was war, interstate highway systems. This is all social engineering, suburbia, things, Hollywood, entertainment, mass media.
Great points.
All working to destroy this. And none of these things were just accidental. This was all malicious social engineering going on here. And which is an excellent segue into your next article about television, isn't it?
Yeah. Say, Tim, this might also be a great point just to take a quick break.
Yeah, certainly. We'll take
we break up?
Okay, good. Okay. Your next article, the real reason there was a golden age of television. Let's say the days of I Love Lucy, Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, back when you could sit back and watch TV with the whole family and not worry about what was going to be broadcast. Mm-hmm. It was wholesome. It brought the family together. And that's when TV was wholesome. And healthy, right?
Yeah, it was called the golden age of television, and it's fondly remembered by people. And, I started out by talking about a time that in the 70s when me and my sister were at my dad's house, and we were in our 20s then. We flicked on the TV. We happened to catch one of these old 90-minute dramas they used to feature back in the 50s. You know, they used to have these things like Playhouse 90 and a Philco television theater, and they had quite a few of these drama series on that had a different cast each week. It wasn't like the 60s when you had every show had the same cast and a different plot.
Yeah, there's an interesting story to that. Is back then people would actually sell TV stories to to the companies that then bought the airtime. So there was General Electric Theater was brought to you. And so there's a lot more creativity within what was being produced. And by the 1960s, because it has something to do with the FCC and regulations, that the studios found it easier just to sort of produce these formulaic TV shows and all that.
Right. I didn't realize there was an FCC underpinning to that. But my sister and I were talking about how we were stunned at how excellent the acting was on this show we happened to see, and we said, why doesn't television make entertainment like that anymore? And so in the article I talk a little about why there's this nostalgia for that age, and I believe that it has a lot to do with the one reason why people feel good about the 50s was besides the fact that we, other than the Korean War, we weren't at war in that decade, but the values people held then. And one thing I find ironic is that television was actually contributing to the moral values of America. What I mean by that is if you watch TV, there was no cursing, there was no sex scenes, any violence was not graphic. And almost every story presented in a drama would have, a moral ending where the person would make, would be making the right choice. And Leave It to Beaver was classic for that. You know, Beaver would always be tempted to do the wrong thing, or his brother Wally occasionally. And they ended up, having to make a decision to make the right choice. And it was morally instructive. And one thing I really found remarkable, though, as I've started to look at this, Tim, is in early 50s, when not many homes had TVs yet, there was a tremendous emphasis on openly Christian content. And the very, hit songs were always introduced on TV, or at least featured on TV. Dick Clark's American Bandstand. But the very first hit song ever introduced on TV was a song in 1953 called I Believe. It was by Frankie Lane. And I don't think the original telecast still exists on video, but I embedded a YouTube version of the song so people can hear it there. It's all about belief in God. And last year, Turner Classic Movies was showing some of the lost TV performances of James Dean. You know, he became a teen idol. Rebel Without a Cause, and he died very young. But he was on TV quite a bit, and I watched one of the episodes called Harvest, and I was amazed at how Christian the content was. This is like 1953, you know. And I hope this won't bore people. I'm just going to – I was watching the actor Ed Begley, who's playing the father. The family's gathered around for Thanksgiving. They've come from all around the country, even though it's hard for them to do so, to meet at the family farm. And James Dean is holding up the kids. And he says this prayer, the father does. He says, "Lord, we thank thee for this wonderful feast on this day of Thanksgiving. We have much to be grateful for. We thank thee for all the good things that have come our way this past year. We thank thee that we may be together here today, all our sons and our sons Joe's wife and our grandchildren. And Lord, we thank thee that our son Chuck has come home to stay. And Lord, don't let me ever forget what Grandpa used to say. Grandpa's died during the show. You always got to set your hopes on tomorrow. Amen." And those are the last words of the broadcast, the drama. And you know, I the more I've looked at it, the more I realized that you know, it was a Christian America. And to convince Christians to buy TV sets, you had to persuade them that, you know, you're going to be seeing Christian content. You're going to hear prayers. And, you know, actually in this particular teleplay, when the grandpa dies, they sing the Lord's Prayer, you know. And this is an episode of Robert Montgomery Presents, you know, one of the drama series back then. And, of course, not all the shows were openly Christian. Some of them, of course, had no references to God. But there was enough of it to persuade the public that TV is a moral medium. It's going to teach your kids values. I mean, Superman would always say at the beginning of the show that he was standing for truth and justice in the American way. And so parents were convinced that this is a great teaching tool for kids. And so naturally you'd want to have this in your home, besides the quality entertainment that we were just talking about, you know, the great dramas that were being showcased back then. And as more and more TVs came into the homes, then the Christian content began to get withdrawn. And there was a particular year where I believe that there was kind of a pivotal year, which I'll get into. But let me throw it back to you. But that's my observation, was that it was Christian moral-centered entertainment that not only made the era memorable, but that's what got the TVs into the homes. That's the first step they had to take, and it could not be immoral, or no one would have bought a TV set in that era.
Yeah, they have to do it gradually, and that's an interesting analysis. I also reminded, I think, of that early 50s Bishop Sheen's television show, where he was just him and the chalkboard explaining philosophy, theology, doctrine, and it was actually beat Milton Berle in the ratings.
I didn't know that. You know, I grew up in an agnostic home. We did not go to church, and so naturally we didn't tune in someone like Bishop Sheen, but the fact that he beat out Milton Berle, who was the king of comedy, I mean, that really says a lot.
And so, again, your point well taken is, in order to introduce this medium into to build people's trust, and also their addiction to it, because I think there's an addicting factor here just with the flicker rate, they had to at first introduce it very benign, positive material so people would accept it. And this is a strategy we see played out in a lot of things, whether it's music. I think the Disney Corporation does this with many of their, you know, Britney Spears or Christina Aguilera or any one of the pop tarts they produce, these things. Hollywood followed a similar problem, method, I think. I think initially Hollywood movies were rather scandalous and really racy in the 20s. And this led to the creation of the Hays Code and the production code. And then this was sort of taken up. Hays was a Protestant. It was taken up by the Catholics, the Legions of Decency, and also Jim Breen out in Hollywood, or Joe Breen. And he pretty much, you know, called Hollywood for what it was, a bunch of degenerates. And, you know, you don't want these people controlling the entertainment fair of the nation. But I've had a few conversations. I do a weekly show with Joe Atwell, and he was talking about how the Hays Code, Legions of Decency, Joe Breen, and these things, and the actually led to the acceptance of Hollywood in America. This led to the the construction of a movie theater in every small town in America. So the distribution network was there to Hollywood to spread its influence. And this is another gradual push. Initially, Hollywood is relatively benign, but at the same time, it's creating the celebrity culture. It's creating this method of propaganda and mind control. And with something that was kept on a short leash up until the 1960s, and this gets us back to the whole demographic warfare that the WASP establishment was waging, particularly against the Catholics, was it wasn't until the sort of the disintegration of the ethnic neighborhoods in the suburbia that they were able to break the production code in 1965. And it's been, you know, pretty much downhill, all downhill since then. But it was interesting that it was the influence of the Catholic Church in the United States, particularly and expressed particularly in these ethnic neighborhoods, where they could boycott movies and people would listen to the bishop or listen to the Monsignor.
Right.
Whereas exactly. Once they're in suburbia and they're losing their ethno-religious identity, the church has very little hold on them. And once they lose their ethno-religious identity, they're sort of empty vessels that can be filled by, you know, all the psychological warfare that Madison Avenue Hollywood has to offer them. And then, you know, we have what we have today. My point was, it's the same gradual approach where it's, at first it's rather benign in these things. And the whole point, I think you get in your address this in the article, isn't so much culture driving TV or Hollywood, it's Hollywood and TV driving the culture.
Right. And, of course they had to fit into the culture that existed, in the era and then gradually tweak it. And actually I did mention in your article that Hollywood had been through a similar transition to one you're referring to. In fact, I've read that when the Legion of Decency closed its offices, I think there was approximately 1966 or 7, that you could really see a change in the Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. You had the first X-rated movies coming out, I believe, in 68, and all of a sudden, and then the first sex scene, sexual intercourse, and it was called I Am Curious Yellow in 1970, and you know everything downhill from there. And but I had never thought about the fact that, as you point out, the fact that these codes existed enabled the distribution system to expand the movie theaters in America. I'd never thought about that, but from my perspective in this article was having the TV be so decent, so Christian, was a way of getting the TVs into the homes. And once they were in the homes, of course, then they could do whatever they wanted. This is a personal observation. I don't know if it's correct. I believe that it is. You know, I think that people down south were probably particularly distrustful of the televisions. You know, there was still that resentment towards the Yankees. And, of course, mm-hmm. these were basically Yankee productions. And I personally believe, I could be wrong, but I used to watch the show when I was a kid. It came out in 1957. I was born in 51, by the way. It was called The Gray Ghost, and it was all about the Confederate cavalry officer, John Mosby, Major Mosby. Now, he was very dashing and daring in real life. You know, in real life, he actually went with a group of about a dozen men into a gigantic Union camp with thousands of soldiers, and he kidnapped, in the middle of the night, he kidnapped the commanding officer. I mean, this guy was sensational. But so they made this series in 57 because I think they did it because they wanted Southerners to start buying TV sets because they figured what Southerner would resist a chance to cheer on Mosby? I mean, they've got Confederate stuff mm-hmm. on here. So I think that what the point I'm making is that TV was strategically introduced in a way that it would appeal to certain demographic groups, you know, particularly the Christians. And so they would buy the TVs, and once they got the TVs, they could start to change it. And what I looking at the actual numbers, TV ownership did not exceed 90% until 1963. 1963, it hit 91.3%. I believe that is the moment when they said we can start to really start to tweak the content because you know it was TVs were quite expensive. Back then, I mean, it was, I believe, the equivalent of a few $1,000 to get a TV if you really adjust the numbers for true inflation. So people were not about to throw their TV sets out just mm-hmm. because there was a few tweaks. But I noticed in 63 myself, and this is from my personal memory but as well as checking against the records, I remember in 63, 64, feeling a real change. I mean, all of a sudden, Leave It to Beaver was gone. Dobie Gillis was gone. They had been showing reruns of Father Knows Best on network television. That stopped in the fall of 63. and they started introducing some creepier content like the Outer Limits that fall. And, you know, my favorite Martian, okay, it's cute, but we know that aliens have a, you know, there's a very demonic dimension to them. And 64, they introduced Bewitched, a very cute witch. Everything was boiling the frog. You know, they're boiling the frog, starting out cute, and eventually it gets utterly satanic like and demonic like it is today. But that's how they did it. They boiled the frog gradually. But it's that fall of 63. I noticed, I mentioned the article, I noticed my classmates suddenly were changing their behavior. Really, kids had really been nice, were no longer acting nice, were really acting strange and cruel. And, you know, you could chalk it up to adolescence, but there were some things going on. We mentioned that in the earlier part of the show that in the summer of 63, the Supreme Court had outlawed not only prayer but the Bible, so God was expelled from the public schools. But something else had happened, which I think was significant, and as a Catholic, you would know a lot more about this, but this was Father Malachi Martin. I don't know if this is true or not, but he says that there was a ceremony on June 29th, 1963, in the Vatican enthroning Lucifer. Now, that was just 12 days after this Supreme Court decision expelling God. He said that was accompanied by satanic rites in the United States. I don't know if you have any perspective on that, Tim, as a Catholic, but the timing, you know, the Kennedy assassination then coming that fall. Do you have any input on what Malachi Martin said about Lucifer in the Vatican in June of 63?
Well, that was interesting because the Pope, I think, at the time, I think 63, was that Paul VI?
I don't know. You would have to tell me.
Paul VI, or was it John the 23rd? Well, Paul VI, Montini, he's the one that said that the smoke of Satan had entered the Vatican. And I guess he's implying that there is some sort of infiltration, and you know, I think it was the Paul Kennedy's book about satanic rites within the church and these things, again, this is something with the church being infiltrated. If that indeed had some sort of alchemical effect on society in general, it's hard to say. I can't see it not having some effect because it's whether it's spiritual or mystical or just practical, because these people doing this are going to hold office within the church and they're going to use that infiltration to spread false doctrine and corrupt corrupt the their flock. But the 63 is a pivotal moment culturally. It's sort of a inflection point culturally for the United States, indeed the entire Western world, because of course we have the assassination of John F. Kennedy in the fall of 63,
right on 11/22, which some would imply as a Masonic number adding up to 33. By the way, as I mentioned in the article, Lexington, where I grew up, Lexington, Mass, has long ties to Freemasonry, going back to the shot fired around the world. I've written an article on that. And the Freemasonic connections to the beginnings of the whole New World Order, actually, in Lexington on April the 19th, 1775, and the Freemason connection to that. But actually, Lexington today is the headquarters for the entire northern jurisdiction of Freemasonry. So there is a big Freemasonic connection, and actually is either in 64 or 65, I believe it was 65, one of the three big networks did a news documentary on the problem of juvenile delinquency in America. And of all the towns in America they could have picked, they picked Lexington, Mass., which to me was confirmation that the changes I saw taking place in that town, it was not just my observation, but even the national news picked up on it. There were kids that were – they had hidden cameras catching kids doing all kinds of stuff. And I distinctly remember one of that was they're ripping open parking meters to steal the coins, and those kids weren't poor. I mean, they were doing that just to be cruel and to be mean.
Well, a lot of it is also when they're doing a show on a problem, whether it's juvenile delinquency or crack or teenage pregnancy, it's actually to spread that problem, to create more of that problem.
Yes, exactly. Well, like the whole thing about sex education, you know, or drug education, it's actually to get people to use it and do it, not to actually prevent it. even though superficially that was given as a purpose.
But as far as this pivotal moment, because you've had, you know, the bloodletting, the assassination of Kennedy, and that's sort of it's make sure it's filmed, of course, you know, so everyone can see it. It's on television. Walter Cronkite's telling people about this, about the death of Kennedy and these things. And just, you know, right after this, you have the, you know, the sort of the beginning of the 60s. You have the Beatles coming in coming to the United States, brought to you on television, of course. And the sudden change in fashion is the idea that music was changing. And I think Michael Hoffman writes about this in his book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, the chemical change that the American culture experienced in 1963. Fashion changed, the music changed, and there's a sudden sort of a decline in public morality in these things, and it's undeniable. And to say that, you know, that would happen at this key moment in 63 was, it's hard to write that off as just sort of a confluence of historical events or culture, you know, responding to these unrelated events. It was culture was being manipulated, and we do know it was at the time, because I do know the CIA was for almost a decade been promoting the use of drugs through Life magazine. That's all part of the MKUltra project. It was promoting sexual deviant behavior. Rockefeller Foundation with Alfred Kinsey. At the same time, the normalization of pornography with Hugh Hefner, which probably had CIA backing. Modern art was being promoted by the CIA. This was the Congress of Culture Freedom and sort of this agenda to promote this type of art. The Rockefellers were largely behind this sort of declaration of aesthetic warfare against the West. It wasn't as if someone, you know, decided, I'll do modern art, I'll sell pornography, and it caught on and give the people what they want. It's more or less telling people what they want and the people responding, because now you have, through technology, you have mass media. You have television, right? And of course, and you make the point in your article about the key moments in American history, particularly wars, follow along sort of a saturation point of a new technology, be it radio, television, and the internet. Correct?
Right. That's an observation that came to me as I looked and I saw that the Vietnam War. You mentioned the Beatles after coming in right after John F. Kennedy's assassination, and right after the Beatles came in, came the Tonkin Gulf incident and the escalation of that war. So that war came in with a new medium, television, and it became known as the first television war. World War II started when radios reached saturation point, you know, in the 30s, and then you had 9/11 coming just about the time when everybody had a home computer connected to the internet. So every time there was a new means of propaganda, you had the three most significant wars of the past century all occurred at those moments. And it seemed like there would be a peaceful time, like in the 30s, the 50s, and the 90s, when they were getting those technologies into the homes, and then they would start with the wars in the propagandizing of those wars through the new medium. I think that's probably not a coincidence. I think that we're looking at an agenda, and, you know, getting back to television, nobody asked that the clean television of the 50s be changed. Nobody asked for curse words to be introduced or sex to be introduced or graphic violence to be introduced. That was manipulated on the public, who it was tweaked on them. They boiled the frog, but it was brought on them gradually. And, you know, someone who confirmed this, and you were the one, I believe, who actually brought this to my attention. You, on a previous broadcast, you mentioned how Anton LaVey, the founder of the Church of Satan, leading Satanists, said that, I believe you're the one who told me that the TV replaced the family altar. And so I went looking for that quote for this article. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it wasn't you, but I'll read the quote. He wrote this in a book called The Devil's Notebook, published in 1992. He said, quote, "The birth of TV was a magical moment foreshadowing its satanic significance. The first commercial broadcast was aired on Walpurgisnacht, which is a celebration of witchcraft, April the 30th, 1939, at the New York World's Fair. Since then, TV's infiltration has been so gradual, so complete, that no one even noticed. People don't need to go to church anymore. They get their morality plays on television. what began modestly as rabbit ears on top of family TV sets are now satellite dishes and antennas pridefully dominating the skyline, replacing crosses on top of churches. The TV set or satanic family altar has grown more elaborate since the early 50s, from the tiny fuzzy screen to the huge entertainment centers covering entire walls with several monitors. What started as an innocent respite from everyday life has become in itself a replacement for real life for millions, a major religion of the masses, the clergy of the TV religion, of those entertainers, newscasters in particular, who nightly spread the word from the cathode road, the cathode ray pulpit, unquote. The Satanist Anton LaVey. So maybe you weren't the one who told me about that, but I found that quote to be in perfect harmony with what I was observing, because I was always curious why we had that golden age of television. It was definitely putting cheese in the trap to catch the mouse.
Mm-hmm. Get us addicted to the cathode ray tube for our information, and now we watch the world through a pixelated reality, which can be manipulated in many ways, and it's to the point where we're sort of faced with sort of an epistemological crisis or befuddlement, because we don't know what's real, what isn't, what's being manipulated. At least those of us who are out there thinking don't know. There are many who just blindly accept what's ever broadcast to them as news, as reality. But we all know what's on that screen isn't necessarily reality. It's just a screen, and it's a TV production, and it's largely entertainment or some sort of amusement or some sort of manipulation. And again, mass communication from the get-go, it's got its start as a form of mass manipulation, mass psychological warfare. That's why it was studied. That's why resources were put into it. It wasn't there to educate, to edify. It was there to manipulate and control. And that's there's a book, Christopher Simpson, called The Science of Coercion. And he actually gets into that, about how all in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it was the War Department, the Pentagon, later the CIA, who poured a lot of money into the universities to study the effects of mass communication, be it radio or television, to more or less turn it into a science. So this stuff isn't accidental. Experts, people with PhDs, academics, scientists, are paid good money to study this stuff to screw with your mind. And that's what it's made. That's why it was developed. It's not the same with the internet. Stuart, you know, look at the internet was formed the same way. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's all that way, or that it can be used. Like right now we're having this conversation on the internet. But what they have to realize is the whole idea, you know, the idea of everyone having a smartphone in their pocket now being completely monitored everywhere they go, even largely what they think by based on what their searches are with their communications and these things. But you mentioned the radio in World War II. It's funny because there was a 1938, of course, that Orson Welles broadcast War of the Worlds. And this was a part of the Princeton Radio Research Project. It wasn't accidental that it caused fear. In fact, it was done on purpose to see, one, how much fear they could create with a fake news broadcast, and then how much, anxiety they could create by exaggerating the tales of overreaction to the event. But the critical year is 1938, because getting fearful of the other, a lot of people thought in 1938 that these aliens were Germans. So they're getting people prepared for the Second World War. And of course,
exactly.
And throughout the war, or even before America's entry, particularly in 1940, you had a stage actor, Ednar Murrow, turned journalist, broadcasting live from London, and they would intentionally have him interrupt TV shows to report from London, you know, on news reports that could wait until the news show. But they knew the psychological effect of interrupting the shadow. You know, would make people think what they were hearing, you know, was news they had to hear now. There was something really important going on, and of course, his job was to drag America into the war, because there he was in London talking about the Blitz. Of course, there was no equivalent of an Ednar Murrow in Hamburg or Dresden, you know, about the bombing there. But this is the use of radio in that critical moment. And, of course, I don't know, TV. I mean, obviously, we've talked about the Vietnam War, how it wasn't just a question of, you know, the hawks waging the war and the hippies undermining the war. Both were part of a dialectic that the elite wanted. They wanted the war. They wanted the trauma of the war. to rend society, to create the divisions within society, to have that chemical effect. And of course, the anti-war protesters were part of that alchemy, and they needed television to do that.
Right, they needed television to change the morality and to create the perception of the war that they wanted. I call it change in America from a Leave It to Beaver society in 1963 to a Woodstock society in 69. Mm-hmm. That was one of the main objectives associated with that war, the multidimensional war, of course, but that was one of their chief objectives, was to change American culture, and was very successful. And of course, on the piggyback to the anti-war movement came the feminist movement and the gay movement, mm-hmm. and all the rest that we, you know, the various mutations that we see today.
Yeah,
of those.
Yeah, it's all, and television is a big part of it, and it's a the optics of it, obviously, because you see one thing, and you're only seeing what's being transmitted on that screen. That's the narrative you get. And it's obviously two-dimensional. It's you know, and people think that's reality, and it has that hold on people's consciousness to this day. You know, obviously television has changed. You know, with the advent of you, even you mentioned it, how now it's designed to lock in everyone's little. Everyone has something. It offers something for everybody now, right? With various channels, and you don't even have to wait for programming. You can watch it a la carte when you want.
Mm-hmm. You know, right. You know. And they even have a few, you know, shows, networks like MeTV, just to, and what I come in, they want to keep the old timers distracted like the rest of the members of the Matrix too. Those who don't want to watch the, you know, the Walking Dead, they can still watch Andy Griffith, you know, yeah. So they'll remain distracted until they get their New World Order into the final stages that they want. The thing is that it's what's happened in the past has never been really mysterious at all, and as you've been pointing out, has been contrived and scientifically designed in order to manipulate changes in the public. And the final word I just ended the article on was the fact that if there was one good thing that came out of the golden age of television, was that it actually proved that these mediums. These media can be used for positive purposes. I mean, you can mm-hmm. actually give people good moral lessons. And I think that TV actually really did in the 1950s through, you know, moral endings and clean entertainment, good role models, you know, Ward, people like Ward Cleaver and mm-hmm. you know, Robert Young on Father Knows Best, actually presenting people with good role models. And I think that people actually did emulate those role models for the time that they were permitted. And so I think that we can say that whether it's music or the graphic arts or the theater or literature, anything can actually be used for very positive outcomes if it's in godly hands. Unfortunately, due to the power of finance and the Luciferians who really do run our world behind the scenes, that usually doesn't happen unless they have ulterior motive for it. But the truth is, the arts can be used in godly and very positive ways for the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a technology. So, as you said, it can be weaponized or it can be used to actually edify and improve. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. as you said, unfortunately, the people, the cultural mandarins, the people in control of these things, obviously have a malevolent intent, and it's not going to be used for those things. For the most part, and you have to be aware of that. And as I think you should follow Howard Beale's advice in Network. turn them off. Turn them right off. Turn them off. Leave them off. Turn them off in the middle of this sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off. And have a conversation with your family member, your wife, your husband, your brother, your neighbor, your friend, or maybe read a book. You know, these things. And be far better off instead of sitting in front of glued in front of that screen. So anyway, well, James, I want to thank you for coming on back on the show.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you for having me on, and you've had you know, a greater array of guests for a long time now, and like I say, word is getting around about your show. I hear it mentioned more and more, and always in very positive terms, and I'm glad you're out there. And you know, it's I hope we've said something tonight that's been edifying to our listeners, but I know just for me, just sitting and having a chat with you like this is edifying for me. I always learn, you know, I always learn something from talking to you, things I didn't know before. And I know that as an interviewer, you must learn quite a few things. Yeah, you must be quite an academic by now just from the input you've had from the great variety of guests that you've hosted over the years.
Well, thanks for those kind words. I stand on the shoulders of giants, as they say. So it's so thank you. And again, I've learned a lot, and you find your articles very provocative and very thought provoking. So so right back at you.
Oh well, thanks very much. Well, I should probably mention my website is jamesperloff.com. That's James Perloff, P as in Peter, E-R-L-O-F-F as in Frank. And I have quite a few articles there on history as well as current events. I did an interview with a Syrian Christian. It's the next to last article. We didn't talk about it tonight, but it's actually had over 7,000 Facebook shares. It's been a pretty popular one, especially with what's going on in Syria and Iran, which is of great concern to me at this current moment. But I have a lot of articles on history there, and my most recent book is Truth is a Lonely Warrior, which is a primer on the New World Order. Truth is a Lonely Warrior, everything from the CFR and the Fed to vaccines and chemtrails, indexed and documented with endnotes, and hopefully something that you can share with one of those skeptics who will begin to change their mind and come draw close to the truth.
Yes, and start thinking again. So, well,
yeah.
Okay, James, I'll let you go. Thanks a lot. I'll post this in a few days. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Well, okay, that's great. How many days would it be? A few, probably.
Might be 3 or 4 days.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'll definitely link to that, and I'll mention it on Twitter more than once. And yeah, great stuff. Fantastic stuff. Your anthology of shows is actually it's like a library of information.
Yeah, it's just a cumulative thing. It's just a series of conversations. So that was my plan, my idea. So mm-hmm. Here I am, yeah. more than 2 years later, and I don't know, 230 shows, I guess. I've lost count. So
fantastic.
And YouTube hasn't cut me off yet. So.
Yeah, that's great. I'm so glad.
I got a couple warnings on one.
Which one was that? I'm just curious.
I just happened to mention Sandy Hook or something in Boston, and they just said it violated their standards and community standards. And I said, where? How am I harassing somebody in these things? So they removed the video. So.
Oh, yeah, I know Sandy Hook has been kind of a hot button for censorship for some reason.
Yeah,
I know
that, isn't that strange?
Fetzer got his book on Sandy Hook taken off of Amazon. So
yeah.
For some reason, they're really, really
hard on them. Fetzer has his critics. I understand that. And some of that criticism may well be deserved. I don't know. But it does strike me as strange that his, you know, why would you pull his book? I mean, why do that? If it's such a crazy book, it's not going to have an impact. So it is suspect,
right.
Yeah.
And undercut your sales too every time you censor a book. So
yeah,
not that Amazon is really in it for the money.
No, Amazon. That's an interesting business model. Their stock continues to skyrocket, but they've never registered a profit.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think they're just in it to take down the retailers, basically,
yeah.
And get a monopoly. Get a monopoly going. I think it's a modern form of John D. Rockefeller Standard Oil.
Yeah, they're creating
a
global company store is the model. And,
right.
And they get all this black budget money infusion. I mean,
Jeff
Bezos, Washington Post, $600 million. You know, and it ain't the free market, that's for sure. So. Okay, well, Jim, I'll let you go. I'll post this in a few days. I'll send it to you and wish you good night.
Okay, good night, Timothy. Thank you very much. Great being with you.
You're certainly welcome, and thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
The local rock group down the street is trying hard comfort